This is Bill Alec reporting for Vortex Network News. And today we have a special guest with us. His name is Dr. Joe Farrell. And Joe is an author and a researcher, and is and has brought forth some very interesting information here. He lectured just a few weeks ago at the UFO Congress in Laughlin, Nevada, and he mentioned some very interesting things on the show, and we're going to talk about them on today's show. And Joe, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, Bill. Thanks for having me back.
Okay, great, great. Yes, at the Nevada show, you talked about some very interesting topics, especially about the, you know, what happened towards the end of World War II.
All
and
right.
I was wondering if you can talk about that a little bit here, you know, with our listening audience.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's my belief, Bill, that we have been sold really a whopper concerning the end of the war, what happened with some of the senior Nazi leadership, the Nazi party, and most importantly, the Nazi technology. But kind of in a nutshell, what I think was going on was that Martin Bormann, whom I believe did escape Nazi Germany and made his way to South America, along with some other top-ranking Nazis, that Martin Bormann more or less coordinated the division of the technological spoils between the Western Bloc, the Western Allies, and then the Soviet Bloc, making sure that we got more or less the rocket scientists, and the Soviets were able to get enough technicians that they would replace or be able to reconstruct the documents that they didn't have that we got. I believe that Bormann steered very, very crucial atom bomb components to the American program as a part of this very covert deal. And that kind of brings up another subject, because I also think that there's a case to be made that Nazi Germany's atom bomb project was probably far more successful than we've been told.
Right.
Now, the reason I put it all this way is because, of course, some of their technology, the most exotic stuff, they kept to themselves. So, you know, that's kind of the overview.
Mm-hmm. You know, during the lecture, you mentioned that there were tons of uranium discovered.
Yes, there was an interesting discrepancy. At the end of the war, the Allies noted that they could not account for about 600 missing tons of uranium that had been enriched. Now, we can't assume that they were enriching all of this to weapons-grade purity, but that's an indicator that they had an extremely sizable uranium enrichment program going on inside of the Third Reich. So, yeah, that's one of the little clues that we have that their atomic bomb program was probably much more successful than we've been told.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned during the lecture that they seem to have all the pieces in place, including
yes.
a delivery system.
Right. The delivery systems were their biggest problem. As you know, I presented kind of an overview of a circumstantial case that they actually may have detonated a nuclear device right around October 9th through the 12th in 1944, which would have placed them, you know, fully 8 months ahead of the Manhattan bomb project test in New Mexico in July of 45. So I do think that there's a case to be made that they did have an atom bomb, a successful atom bomb program. And I kind of outline all of that case in my first book concerning Nazi secret weapons. It's called Reich of the Black Sun. But there is a very, very strong case to be made that they did have this technology and were successful. The delivery systems were their problem, as you point out. They had, I think, begun to test some of their long-range intercontinental rockets, but I don't think that they were successful in getting them into production. And, of course, their other problem was they didn't simply have a sufficient number of transatlantic planes to be able to deliver an A-bomb successfully to this country, although they were certainly, in my opinion, going in that direction by the end of the war.
Uh-huh. Now, what about that aircraft they had?
The Junkers 390?
Yes, yes. Do you know what the range on that craft?
Well, that is one of the most interesting airplanes in the Nazi inventory, Bill. That was a massive six-engine, long-range, ultra-heavy-lift aircraft. It was one of the first aircraft in the world that was designed for mid-air refueling, which was a technique that the Luftwaffe had investigated and kind of pioneered during the war. But even without that, Bill, this aircraft was capable of flying nonstop all the way from Nazi Germany to Argentina, which, in fact, is what I think happened to one of them at the end of the war. We can kind of get into that a little later, but it was a craft that was used to transport a lot of this stuff and technology and documents outside of Nazi Germany as the war was nearing its conclusion. But, mm-hmm. Yeah, this was an enormous, enormous aircraft. You'll recall the picture I put in my presentation. You know, it's an aircraft that's kind of hard to miss.
Well, that seems to me to be the delivery system for this atom bomb.
Well, the problem here again is that craft was really designed as a transport plane. It didn't have bomb bays or anything like that. It was actually a plane that was loaded in the rear, like a C-5A Galaxy. You know, you can load those things from the front, and some of our other heavy lift aircraft has a ramp that can be loaded from the rear. Well, that was the case with this Junkers 390. It wasn't an aircraft that would have been capable of delivering a bomb accurately, although they were certainly working toward the end of the war on modifying that aircraft and some of their other long-range bombers to be able to carry nuclear weapons, and that's a known and established fact. There's a group of German researchers that have made that case, in my opinion, fairly substantial. But this was an aircraft that they certainly did use and planned to use for their strategic evacuations of technology at the end of the war.
Okay. Okay, now, during the conference there, well, during mm-hmm. your lecture, uh-huh. They used slave labor.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah, in these plants.
Right.
Now, you made a connection between, Auschwitz and and the nuclear, well, their atom bomb project. Is that correct?
Yes, that is, Bill, that's one of the most interesting mysteries of the war, and
right.
it kind of takes a little bit of setting up to explain why.
Okay.
The man that actually designed Auschwitz was an SS, four-star SS general by the name of Hans Kammler. Now, interestingly enough, this is the man who, by the end of the war, is in charge, oversight of all of Nazi Germany's secret weapons research projects. So that's our first little clue that part of the purpose, the hidden purpose of these slave labor concentration camps was not simply for the extermination of people that the Nazis didn't like, but they were also to provide the labor pool for some of these secret weapons projects. So in other words, what we're looking at right away is a project that is so much larger than the Manhattan Project in terms of its ability to tap into a vast, vast slave labor pool. You know, at one time, this would have given Kammler access to about 14 million people. So, you know, the part about the Allied legend that the Germans were not able to accomplish the bomb simply because they didn't have enough manpower, well, that falls by the wayside right away. Now, this Auschwitz plant, basically, and let's call it that because it's partly a plant and partly a concentration camp, as everybody knows. At Auschwitz, the German firm of IG Farben had decided before the war to build an extremely large, I mean, we're talking the mother of all synthetic rubber plants at Auschwitz, okay? Now, the problem with this plant is that they brought in to the region over 10,000 German contract technicians and laborers to build this thing and then run it, okay? The second thing that this plant required was about 25,000 slave laborers from the camp itself. So in other words, we're talking about the synthetic rubber plant to end all synthetic rubber plants. And of course, synthetic rubber was a technology that Farben had patented. So in other words, they were very competent at doing this sort of thing. The problem is that this plant suffered constant breakdowns during the war, number one. The second problem is that this plant used more electricity than the entire city of Berlin, which is the eighth largest in the world at the time. So in other words, this plant is huge. And the final problem, and this is this is the real whopper, is that it's in production. It's actually in use from 1940 to 1944. And according to the Farben executives that we placed on trial at the Nuremberg tribunals, during that entire period of operation, this plant produced not 1 ounce of synthetic rubber. In other words, we're being asked to believe that one of Germany's most technologically sophisticated firms had wasted approximately 250 million Reichsmarks to build this thing, which in today's dollars is $2 billion. That gives you an idea of the enormous size of this facility. That it suffered constant breakdowns and so on and so forth, and they hadn't produced any contribution to the German war effort whatsoever. Now, there is, to me, a technology that explains all of these anomalies, particularly the high electrical power consumption, and that is precisely uranium enrichment. And that would also explain why this plant is suffering the constant breakdowns, because the technologies available to the Germans were roughly the same as what we had, thermal diffusion and mass spectrometry, separation tanks, and so on. In cyclotrons. So that would explain or rationalize why they're suffering this constant breakdown and why they're using so much electricity. I think this was actually a huge Oak Ridge-sized uranium enrichment facility that was being used to enrich uranium for their atomic bomb program.
Mm-hmm. Now, the process that the Germans were using at the time for mm-hmm. uranium enrichment, didn't they use mm-hmm. didn't they pioneer a centrifuge or something?
I know where you're going. Yeah, they pioneered a lot of technology. The centrifuge separation technology is basically a German invention. The Nazis were very keen on this technology, and probably they used a lot of these things en masse, like we used various technologies at Oak Ridge, and simply passed uranium through these centrifuges several times. I think they probably also had a couple of the equivalents of Lawrence's beta calutrons, which are basically cyclotrons with separation tanks, because that was certainly a technology that they also had. And in fact, if you investigate it a little bit more, you'll discover that a German inventor by the name of Baron Manfred von Ardena had perfected a method very similar to Lawrence's that was slightly more efficient in its ability to separate enriched uranium. But there's another technology I mentioned at the conference, and I kind of want to mention it here, and this is a very advanced one. This is a second or third generation technology. When the war ended, Bill, the Allies took several of the Nazi atom bomb scientists to Farm Hall, England, and secretly recorded their conversations. And when the German scientists heard on the BBC that the Allies had dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima, the German scientists sit around and debate on how the Allies did it. And, of course, the process or the conversation naturally turns to the process of enriching uranium to do it. And one German scientist by the name of Wirtz says, well, it's fairly easy to understand what the technology was that they were using. All you do is you take a certain wavelength and irradiate the isotope that you want with a certain wavelength. And at that point, an odd thing happens. All the other scientists begin to talk as if they're trying to drown him out. And so you never really hear what he is going to say. It kind of gets lost in the conversation. But then as the conversation dies down, another scientist by the name of Paul Hartig answers Heisenberg with an interesting statement. Heisenberg says, well, they would have required an enormous labor pool for that. We didn't have that. And Hartek chimes in and he says, oh, well, you only need 10 men for that. I was amazed at what I saw at IG. Okay? Now, there is an interesting technology that does exist that can enrich uranium, and it's called laser isotope separation. And it was a technology that really only becomes publicly known towards the late 1970s, early 1980s, okay? Now, I thought, well, that's interesting. Maybe this is the technology that they're talking about here, but I never really kind of tried to prove that they were doing that. But later on, I ran across in my research a Luftwaffe document that was dated to 1944. And it's, you've seen the document. You were there at the presentation. It's basically just kind of a talking points memorandum that was drawn up by this Luftwaffe scientist working on some sort of secret project for them. And these are briefing points he's going to give to a Nazi field marshal that's coming to find out about this project. And it's clear in the talking points that this project has gone through its proof of concept stages, and they're going to scale this whole thing up massively. And in the very last talking point, this scientist mentions, that what we're going to be doing or utilizing here is the cascade principle. Now, that leaps off the page at me, Bill, because as you know, that is precisely the physics involved in lasers. So I got to thinking, well, there is one technology, yes, that the Nazis, if they were using or trying to pioneer laser isotopes separation technology at Auschwitz, that would account for why IG Farben is experiencing so many breakdowns. The centrifuges and other things like that really wouldn't account for it, but that would, and the reason why is that in developing this technology, the Nazis are really literally going to have to perfect it by brute force. They're going to have to try various chemical gases for the lasing cavity. They're going to have to find out what the proper wavelengths for various isotopes is that they want to separate and enrich, and so on and so forth. So I think there's another clue when you put the farm hall transcripts and this conversation about irradiating isotope with particular wavelengths, that they're talking about the cascade principle and so on. I think all of these are little clues that, again, point to the possibility, and I think it's a strong one, that they were working with some sort of prototypical laser isotope enrichment technology. And if that's the case, then we are dealing with a very, very sophisticated atomic bomb program for the day.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Absolutely.
Yeah,
amazing.
It really is.
Yes. So so the Germans had laser technology.
not just lasers, but we're talking, you know, tunable gas lasers here, you know, that they're using to enrich isotope. And again, you know, the other kind of coincidental little data point that would back that up is what is IG Farben's specialty? Well, it's gases and dyes. So, you know, this would be the perfect company that you would get. And I puzzled over this for a long time. Well, if they're enriching isotope and using centrifuges and cyclotrons, why didn't they get Siemens to build the plant? Well, the reason being is if this is one of the principal technologies that they're trying to pioneer, then IG Farben would have been the logical choice to build the plant. So I think, again, you know, all these clues kind of point in that direction. And there's one final one I want to mention. I'm not trying to take up time with this point, but I think it's so fascinating. The final point is that there's really no other technology or thing mentioned in those farm hall transcripts that would warrant the British keeping them classified until 1992, which they did, you know, which is an odd thing. If the Nazis are such nuclear engineering bunglers, then why would you keep anything that they would have to say classified for that long? And I think that's your answer. I think there is a significant clue in those transcripts that they were using a second or third generation technology to enrich their isotopes.
Huh, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
Absolutely fascinating. Now, just to recap what we have here, you know, in this manufacturing scenario, we had this huge plant, and next to this huge plant was this slave labor pool, you know, Auschwitz, for example.
Right.
Now, you made a very interesting point during this lecture that, you know, the secrecy involved, okay, in this plant, the secrecy, it had to continue even after the war. with Auschwitz to keep the technology secret. And it seemed to lead to a conclusion here why so many died in these concentration camps.
Well, the grisly reality or logic, Bill, I think that this all points to, and this is not the only case, incidentally, that we have a concentration camp located close to some of these secret SS, secret weapons projects. The Bell itself is another point in a data point in that case, because it was also located, its facilities were located near the Gross Rosen concentration camp, and some of those people were forced to work on that project. So what we have is these slave labor camps are really, if you look at the maps where they're located, most of them are located suspiciously close to where the Nazis have some sort of secret weapons project underway. And the grisly logic is that you can quite literally get rid of any security leaks on a permanent basis if you so choose, and this certainly the Nazis did. There were some, I think the people that died in this Auschwitz plant as a result of working in it numbered somewhere between 25 and 50,000 people, and this is the reason that the Farben executives were put on trial at the Nuremberg trials. So, yeah, this is the grisly logic. The Nazis have this vast labor pool that they can tap into, and it immediately secures those projects in absolute secrecy, because, again, when you have a leak or if you suspect that there is a certain group of people that are planning to escape or so on and so forth, you can simply quite literally kill them. Mm-hmm. So that's the gruesome logic behind their secret weapons projects. And I think the reason the Allies have kind of obfuscated this connection is, as I indicated, Bormann probably struck some sort of very high-level covert deal with the United States to surrender some of these functional atomic bomb components to the United States towards the end of the war. And in order to keep the fact that we're relying on some of this technology that was purchased at this enormous cost in human suffering, we had to obfuscate this connection between the camps and their secret weapons projects.
Hmm. Amazing.
It wow. is. It really is a huge story.
Mm-hmm. Now, where does this this U-boat come into the picture here?
Well, towards the end of the war, there's a scenario that was reconstructed by an American researcher named Carter Heydrich, and that's kind of the scenario that I outline at the conference and that I summarize in my book called The Nazi International. There was a U-boat at the end of the war that was numbered the U-234, which I don't want people to be confused. That's the U-boat, not the uranium, okay? Because this U-boat, it's very confusing, but this U-boat also was taking about 80 kilos of enriched uranium. It was in the form of yellow powder, which is a significant clue, and it was placed inside of gold cylinders, and that's another significant clue here, because, as you know, enriched U-235 that's been enriched to high weapons grade purity, you don't put in lead to shield it. And the reason why is lead is very corrosive with uranium, and it will corrupt the sample of uranium. So gold is the metal of choice when you're dealing with shielding and storage of highly enriched uranium at that time. So this is our little clue that this 80 kilos of enriched uranium is highly enriched. In other words, that again, we're not dealing with an incompetent nuclear program at all. We're dealing with quite the reverse. Well, these cylinders are placed into this U-boat, and also in the U-boat there are approximately 25 infrared proximity fuses, the blueprints and their inventor, okay? This U-boat sets out for Japan, where it's ultimately bound, but there is a very clear power struggle. I go into this in quite a great detail in my book. There's a power struggle between Admiral Dönitz, who controls the U-boats, and the Führer bunker itself, which is trying to take control of this U-boat and eventually succeeds. The U-boat is made to return to Hamburg, Germany, where it had sailed from Norway. It apparently picks up two passengers, and then for 12 days, its logs go completely silent. And then after that 12 days, the U-boat makes its way across the North Atlantic, where very suspiciously it encounters Canadian Navy forces. The Canadians order it to surrender at Halifax. And at this point, Bill, America begins to jam our ally Canada's radio signals. The U-boat continues on its way and eventually rendezvous with an American destroyer, which communicates with the U-boat by semaphore, and the U-boat is ordered to proceed to Portsmouth, to surrender at Portsmouth, which it does. Now, all of this suggests to me again that this U-boat is being carefully steered by someone both on the Nazi side and on the American side, okay? When it surrenders to the United States, an interesting thing happens. The Navy immediately reworks the cargo manifest of this U-boat and drops any mention of this enriched uranium. The second thing that happens is that the inventor of these proximity fuses and the fuses themselves are taken to the Pentagon, where under the chairmanship of a Mr. Alvarez, who I think happens to be Dr. Luis Alvarez from the Manhattan Project, who's the very man who wins the Nobel Prize for quote-unquote solving the fusing problem for the plutonium bomb. This German scientist gives a briefing under his chairmanship at the Pentagon to top American brass, okay? And I think the reason why is, again, this plain and simple physics, because the plutonium bomb, as you know, you have to compress that plutonium core very symmetrically, and you have to do it very quickly. And none of our existing fuse technology would allow us to do that. But infrared proximity fuses are kind of a handy thing to have around when you're trying to build a plutonium bomb, because, of course, those things will be made to fire at the speed of light, okay? They're not reliant on circuitry or anything like that. So, yeah, I think that you have definitely the bleeding or the deliberate leaking by Bormann of a technology to make our plutonium bomb work. Plus, he gives us enough fissile uranium to make a uranium bomb work. And it's interesting to me that after this U-boat surrenders, I cite a document, I didn't do it in the presentation, but in my book I cite a document from the chief metallurgist at the Manhattan Project at Los Alamos, who tells, basically in the memorandum, tells about the fact that, well, we'll have enough fissile uranium for a bomb in November of 1945, okay? But interestingly enough, after this German U-boat surrenders, Oak Ridge's stocks or output of enriched uranium double within 2 weeks. So again, all the clues are pointing to the fact that a lot of our Manhattan Project bomb accomplishments were probably due to this deliberate infusion of Nazi technology into the project.
God, that's amazing.
Yeah, it is.
I'm just astounded by this.
Yeah, it is. It's a huge, huge story. And again, if any one detail is not true, the fact remains that the other details are significant enough in themselves to make it a huge story. So again, I think, you know, we're dealing with something very huge. And the real clincher for me, Bill, was I found a document. It's called the Zinsser Affidavit, and you recall I presented it at the conference. And in this affidavit, it's an affidavit of a German pilot that was taken prisoner of war after the end of the war. But in it, he's describing something that he saw in October, around October 10th through the 11th of 1944, as he's flying his plane out over the Baltic Ocean, okay? What he describes seeing is, in his own words, an atomic bomb test, okay? And then he proceeds to describe seeing a pressure wave of about a kilometer diameter, okay, which would be commensurate with a nuclear explosion. And he describes seeing a mushroom cloud standing over the spot where this thing went off. And those are his words again, a mushroom cloud. Those aren't put in there by me. Those are his exact descriptions. And he describes also the continuing combustion of nuclear material in the cloud. So in other words, it's not a conventional explosion that he's seeing. And the final thing he describes is the malfunction of the electrical equipment in his airplane. Okay? Now, Bill, all of this is at a time when none of this is really popularly known, okay? Certainly not by a German prisoner of war who wouldn't have access to the newsreels that the Allies were showing of A-bombs going off over Japan, okay? And in fact, I don't think the Allies did show that for several months after the event. So in other words, he's describing perfectly what he sees as a pilot seeing this thing go off, and what he's describing perfectly matches and is consistent with the explosion of an atomic bomb by the Nazis in October of 1944. And here's the kicker. This affidavit wasn't declassified until 1992. Which significantly is after German reunification. So again, I think we have probably the most significant clue in this whole story.
God. Amazing stuff.
Now, yeah, it really is. It really is. It's scary when you get right down to it.
Yeah, I mean, the Germans, they had it all.
Yeah, they really did, you know, and that's probably the scariest thing of them all. They had so much technology that was actually deployed or at least tested by the end of the war. It truly is scary.
Mm-hmm. Now you mentioned you were showing some were they silicon wafers or some sort of semiconductor technology?
Oh, yes, that is another really significant part of this story.
When was this, during the 40s, early 40s?
This was actually those little wafers that I showed during my presentation. They're little circular wafers, semiconductor chips is what they are, and they were actually built or manufactured by the Germans right around 1940-41. So, in other words, this is way before the end of the war. The pictures that I showed were taken by the Allied intelligence teams that went into Nazi Germany after the war and found all this stuff. Well, the interesting thing is, as you know, I also have a picture of a little klystron tube that's about as big as the last knuckle on your finger, okay? And this tube was in production, I'd say from about mid-1940 and really ended major production in 1941, and they were used in these very, very small radios that were being produced for the German military. Well, Bill, the Allied equivalent of this tube at the end of the war is 10 times bigger. So, in other words, they're miniaturizing electronics components, and they're making major strides in the technology tree to the transistor, okay? Mm-hmm. So that, to me, is another part of this story, because, as you know, the history of the development of the transistor by Bell Labs is a little fuzzy, to say the least, okay? And this has been used by so many people, Colonel Corso being probably the most famous example, to point the finger to crashed ET technology and back engineering for the source of a lot of this stuff. And he also mentions lasers. Well, my point with all this, Bill, is that you don't have to go to ET to rationalize a hidden development of this technology because,
right,
again, most of the finger is pointed to Nazi Germany.
Yes. God.
Yeah, it's, you know, that probably is the biggest whopper because, you know, as I mentioned in the presentation, there's five things that Corso mentions as having been crashed and recovered ET technology from Roswell, and they are lasers, particle accelerators, transistors, fiber optics, and Kevlar, okay? Now, with the exception of Kevlar, I can find you in the documents at least a suggestion that the Nazis were developing something similar, and that even includes fiber optics, because we find in some of the documents that this country recovered at the end of the war a reference to a secret project in what the Nazis were calling optical telephony, okay? Well, if you have that statement and you have the Nazis working on lasers, which I think clearly they were, and second and third generation tunable lasers to boot, you know, if you have this technology and all of these things going on, then the only thing that we can't find a Nazi antecedent for in Colonel Corso's list is Kevlar.
Hmm. Now, this Kevlar material, do you know when that came about?
Well, as far as I've been able to tell, there was a DuPont researcher, I forget what her name was, a research scientist that was experimenting in these materials back in the 1960s, and in fact, there's kind of a suggestion that she may have been doing so in the 1950s. But again, you know, I haven't researched Kevlar that extensively because I'm largely focused on the Nazi technology. But, you know, again, if this is the case, we have a terrestrial antecedent, clearly, for some of this technology, including even in the case of Kevlar. So I think, you know, that when it comes right down to it, we have to look to the fact that Colonel Corso himself points a very subtle finger in his book towards Nazi Germany as somehow being connected with all this technology that allegedly was found at Roswell. And, you know, the other suspicious thing, at least to my mind, is that Corso himself was involved in Operation Paperclip, vetting some of these German scientists to bring over to this country. So I think all the fingers really are not pointing to E.T. for this stuff. I think they're pointing squarely and firmly to the Third Reich.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Very interesting.
Yep.
Now, that's the... Now, you're referring... with Corso's description there with the Roswell crash?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yes, I am. His book, The Day After Roswell, that's where I took that bit of the presentation from. If you recall, I quoted from page 4 where he lists these technologies as having been involved in the crash and later seeded into American industry after they'd been back engineered. Well, mm-hmm. Again, my point in tracing out all of these technologies in Nazi Germany is to show the fact that we don't have to go to E.T. to rationalize this technological development, because a lot of this stuff was being very deliberately investigated and prototype technologies being designed by the Third Reich during World War II.
Mm-hmm. Which we'll get into that next hour.
Sure.
In regards to the Nazi Bell and that related technology there.
Right.
This first hour, you know, we'll just touch on, you know, the background. You know,
right,
on,
right.
How all this came about. And,
right.
You know, this research goes back to the turn of last century.
Yes, yes.
With Einstein's work and... and also the others in this field,
right?
That really, even this engineer, I believe by the name of Kron.
Krom.
Yes.
Oh, Krohn, Gabriel Krohn. Okay,
Gabriel
yes.
Gabriel Krohn. Yes.
Yes. Well, he is, to me, one of the most significant figures, and that kind of gets us towards the Bell story. But basically, Krohn was an electrical engineering genius, and you know, I have some of his papers, Bill, and I've read them, and they're really breathtaking that this man is doing this work in the 1930s and 40s to boot. But the interesting thing about Krohn is he sat down and he began looking at these unified field theories that were being published largely in Germany in the 20s and 30s, beginning with the paper of the German mathematician Theodor Kaluza, who comes up with the first hyperdimensional unified field theory that unifies electromagnetism and gravity, okay, and that was 1921. Einstein so loved the theory that he eventually allowed it to be published in the Prussian Journal of the Sciences, and himself became kind of enamored and intrigued with the idea that Kaluza had come up with of these higher dimensional unifications of electromagnetism and gravity, so that Einstein himself began, of course, to write about unified field theories in kind of a cursory way in 1925. He publishes his first paper on the subject, and then in 28 he publishes his first kind of fully fleshed out theory for it. So you have this spate of publications inside of Germany between the wars concerning these unified field theories. Well, Krohn sits down as an electrical engineer and begins to investigate these theories. And in 1935, he publishes a paper, and this earns him the Montefiore Prize from the University of Liège in Belgium, of course, which is right across, you know, the border from Nazi Germany. And in this paper, what he basically says is that these unified field theories can be used to explain the types of anomalies that we electrical engineers look for and see and find in large rotating networked electrical systems. Okay? Now, if you stop and consider what he's just told you, is that with 1935's technology, we can engineer the fabric of space-time locally on the laboratory bench, and in the process, we might be able to come up with some sort of field repulsion anti-gravity. That's what he's really said. That's the implication of his remarks. Now, interestingly enough, right about this period, all publication of unified field theories inside of Nazi Germany stops. So I think what's happening here is that the Nazis have certainly clued in to what Krohn has just told them. And because of the fact that Theodor Kaluza's unified field theory is a theory that's being published by a scientist, by a mathematician, who is not a Jew, okay, this is another key point. I think all of this kind of put in the cauldron is the ferment that makes the Nazis investigate a completely different paradigm of physics based on these higher-dimensional unified field theories, and they have deliberately, therefore, of course, tossed aside general relativity, and they're going after this stuff that can be engineered, and that's a truly, truly frightening prospect.
Mm-hmm. Now, we seem to have all the pieces here put together, mm-hmm. except for one, and that's this anti-gravity technology, which is what we'll get into next hour.
Right.
But all these technologies seem to come about from Germany here and then introduced into industry back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s here.
Right. Right. Well, this is another interesting aspect of the story, and it's something that actually was brought to my attention by a researcher named Michael Schratt after the Laughlin conference. He's done a number of presentations on American Air Force black projects that concern field propulsion. And he points out the fact that, you know, as Nick Cook and others have observed, publication in the open literature inside of this country on anything relating to anti-gravity ceases right around 1955, okay? Now, it's interesting to me because, as you know, I make a case that part of the Bell Project was continued independently by Nazis working in Argentina in the 1950s, okay? The project was shut down, and the scientist that was the head of it basically was left to hang out and dry by the Nazis and by the Argentines. He was basically without any work. And it's during this precise period, around 1954 to 55, that the U.S. Air Force secretly contacts this scientist and conducts a number of interviews with him. So I find it very suspicious that you have this Bell Project, which has continued in Argentina after the war. The Nazis shut it down and most likely move it elsewhere. They hang the scientist out to dry. America stops publication of anti-gravity papers in the mid-50s. So I think, again, this is another little significant clue that we are trying to get our hands on some of this Nazi technology even as late as 1955. In a certain sense, Bill, when I'm writing these books and doing this research, I feel like I'm writing the screenplay to a really bad Hollywood B movie, because that's the way it sounds. But I can assure you, when you get into the documentation for all of this stuff, it's really a rather frightening story.
Mm-hmm. And all that we can do is, put these pieces together.
Right.
And, try to figure out what's really going on.
What's going on. Yeah, right.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, because it's quite an enigma here. And it's quite perplexing, really.
Yes, it is.
Because, you know, we're seeing all this UFO activity going on in the sky here, and we don't know if it's ET or if it's ours. It's a real mystery. Which brings up a conference we're going to be having in Sedona, Arizona. It's called the UFO Skywatch, Ed Grimsley's UFO Skywatch. And the listeners out there can check out our website. It's Ed Grimsley's. It's called the UFOSkywatch.com. And the listeners out there can go and check out this website. It's a conference coming up end of May. And so, Joe, we just have a few minutes left here in this first hour. The next hour, we'll get into the Nazi Bell Project.
Right.
And some interesting experiments I conducted myself just a few weeks ago. And we'll talk about them. We'll get into that next hour here.
Okay.
Just now, to finish up this hour, what kind of loose ends do you think we can tie together here?
Well, I think the loose ends that we should tie together, or perhaps kind of summarize the context that we've been talking about. The Bell Project was classified Kriegsentscheidend, or war decisive as it translates into English, by the Nazis. In other words, it was the only project that was classified this way, and therefore at the very pinnacle of German secret research. Now, that should give one pause, because if we're dealing with miniaturized electronics that are definite steps on the technology tree to the transistor, if we're dealing with jet aircraft and rockets and Nazi atom bombs and all of this stuff, which the Nazis themselves don't view as war decisive, then that gives you an idea of the potential that they saw with this Bell project and what they were possibly after with it. Because, you know, if it is war decisive and the atom bomb isn't in their estimation, then this is a clue that the physics that they're trying to investigate and engineer with this project is truly, truly breathtaking stuff.
Interesting. Okay. Your website.
My website is www.GizaDeathStar, that's all one word, it's all lowercase, .com. And I have articles there, and my books and so on and so forth are found there.
Mm-hmm. And you've written, how many books? About a half a dozen books?
I've written so far 9. I'm working on a 10th. 5 of them are concerning various aspects of Nazi secret weapons, and in particular various aspects of the Bell Project. It's really a story that can't be handled sufficiently in one book, unfortunately. But I outline this whole case in 5 books. Do you want the titles?
Yes, please.
Okay, the first book is called Reich of the Black Sun. That's essentially about the Nazi A-bomb and some of the other projects that they were working on. The second book is called The SS Brotherhood of the Bell. That one specifically is about the Bell. It kind of introduces people to the project. The third book is called Secrets of the Unified Field. That goes kind of into what I think is the physics and engineering basis for the Bell Project. The fourth one is called The Philosopher's Stone, Alchemy and the Secret Research for Exotic Matter. And in part of that book, I examine the so-called recipe for the fuel that they were using in this Bell device. And then the final book is called The Nazi International, which basically is a story, Bill, about this post-war extraterritorial Nazi organization and the fact that it's continuing the Bell Project research independently of any of the Allies or the Soviets after the war, and continuing it precisely in Argentina. So those are the 5 books.
Okay, and people can order your books where?
Well, the best place, if they want to order them directly from the publishers, Adventures Unlimited Press has published 4 of them, and that number is 1-800-718-4514 during normal business hours. Philosopher's Stone was published by Feral House, F-E-R-A-L. And if they don't want to contact the publishers, probably the easiest way to order the books would simply to be to go on Amazon and get them there, because Amazon carries them all.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to have some questions about getting a book on Amazon.
Okay.
Yes, my fiance Aurora has her book, Prepare for the Landings, and we're trying to figure out how to get that on Amazon.
The easiest way that has been my experience is if you're publishing the book self-publish, I think the easiest way is simply to contact Amazon directly and offer it. If it's published by a publisher, the publisher and his distributor will probably see to it that Amazon will get it. It usually takes, in my experience, Bill, it takes about a month from when a publisher actually gets the book from the printer to get it to Amazon. So the turnaround is about a month. Mm-hmm. But most distributors of books are going to make sure that Amazon is aware of it. And Amazon, in my experience, will carry books by the smallest publishers. So eventually they do get the information. But if you're trying to kind of push things along, it doesn't hurt to contact them directly and say this particular book is available from this particular publisher and give them the title and ISBN numbers and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, my guest today was Dr. Joe Farrell, and a really fascinating discussion here on what was really going on from the technology point of view here of the Germans. Because I've heard for many years that German technology was like second to none, you know, back in the 30s and 40s. And it's beyond that. I mean, the level of technology was just incredible. And that finishes up this first hour. I'd like to ask our listeners to keep tuned in here for the second hour with Joe Farrell. And we're going to be talking about the Nazi Bell experiment and beyond. So stay tuned, everyone. This is Bill Alec for Vortex Network News. Everyone, this is Bill Alec. In this new book that just premiered at the Academy of Arts and Sciences in Hollywood, California, delves into our connection with human-appearing extraterrestrials. In Prepare for the Landings, authors Michael Elejon and Aurora Light go into their long-standing contacts and what's in store for all of us here on planet Earth. In Prepare for the Landings, you will learn why this planet has been quarantined and how the ET connection to the Bible and other ancient writings has been deliberately suppressed. Go to prepareforthelandings.com and prepare yourself for the coming shift of the ages taking place right now. That's prepareforthelandings.com. Get your copy today and don't be left behind. Go to prepareforthelandings.com.
Connect with the angels to receive spiritual support and loving guidance. Hello, this is Dana Marie, host of Intuitive Guidance on Achieve Radio. On the third Sunday of every month, like minds gather at a blessed location in New York City to exchange clairvoyant readings and healings. We conduct meditative techniques to channel higher frequencies. The angels surround us in healing light and divine wisdom with beautiful, uplifting messages to share. For more information about the gatherings in New York City, visit angelspirithealing.net or call 347-626-2558. Join us to connect with the angels.
Roses, the man he said to me. Oh, someday, boy, you might have to go and set somebody free. And oh, well, if the sun, if the sun refuses you to shine, gotta find a way to light your own road some of the time.